I'm going to start off with an apology, which is always the best way to start with this information. My apology is that this is more like a sort of review paper of some of the work that myself and colleagues at the Jill Demo Institute have been doing. And it's probably going to be perhaps more useful for those of you that aren't criminologists and those of you that are, because I'm going to be talking about some basic issues that you should be thinking about when you're trying to specify crime risk models. And two particular issues that I'm going to be talking about are the issues of boundaries and environmental backcloths. And what do I mean by issues related to these? Well, the specification of your boundaries and the environmental backcloth that you use is going to have a real effect both on the way that your crime model looks and also on how good your crime model is at predicting where crime is going to happen in the future. So I'm going to sort of illustrate how you can fall foul of problems with boundaries and also how using certain elements of the environmental backcloth can substantially improve crime risk models. While I do this, I'm also going to touch on the whole topic, which I'm not sure has been raised yet, of crime risk model accuracy. And I think the reason why this is important is a lot of hotspotting, hotspotting programs that have been done today produce nice looking hotspots. But one question you might say is, okay, so that shows you where the hotspots are, but how accurate is that particular program at identifying where future crime is going to happen? And that's the type of question that the police particularly are very interested to answer. So not only, okay, so this is where my hotspot is, but if I go to that hotspot, will I really be catching the crime that happens in the next 10 days or 3 days or whatever your time period is? So I'm going to talk about how it's important to look at accuracy, and also I'm going to talk a little bit about utility of maps. So you might come up with a map that's quite accurate, but is it actually useful in an operational sense for police officers? Then I'm going to just talk about a few future projects which sort of stem from various bits of my talk about boundaries and environmental backcloths. So it's sort of, this is where we're at, how can we take these things forward? Okay, so this is a revision for those of you that are geographers, but others of you might not be aware of this problem. MARPOL, the Modifiable Area Unit problem, summarises some of the problems that we have with identifying boundaries for crime risk models. And Openshaw puts this particularly well, I think. He says, the aerial units used in many geographical studies are arbitrary, modifiable, and subject to the whims and fancies of whoever is doing or did the aggregating. So what we can get from Openshaw is basically that you can define boundaries in all sorts of different ways. And there are a staggering number of different options for aggregating data. I'm sure most of you are aware that administrative boundaries vary widely between different types of organisations. So we've got, for instance, in the UK, we have a system where we have police beat boundaries, and there's a hierarchical structure of administrative boundaries for the police. You've got the local police beat, and these fit into what's known as a basic command unit, and then those basic command units fit together to make what we'd call a police force operational area. So they're sort of hierarchical boundaries. But you can, and quite often the police use these boundaries to map their data, but there are problems with sticking to those types of boundaries, as I'll show you later on. There's also the option of creating your own boundaries, and quite a lot of research now uses automatic non-overlapping boundaries. So basically identifying boundaries as a series of grids or polygons that have been put together across a particular area of interest. And maybe the advantage of using these types of automatic boundaries is that you can specify boundaries that are the same area as each other across the whole of your area of interest. Now, sort of relating to the modifiable area unit problem, there are two particular problems that exist. There's a problem with scale, which is the variation which occurs when data from one scale of interest is aggregated into more or less units. And perhaps a good way of illustrating this problem is you might imagine you've got a ward, a local authority ward, which Bill was saying this morning holds perhaps about 12,000 people in Britain. And it might have a fairly average crime rate. But inside that ward, you might find that when you look in depth, that there's two different estates, one which has got a very high crime rate and one that's got a very low crime rate. But the overall effect that you get if you map at the more aggregate level is that that's just an average problem. So you have to really think about what's within your boundaries and whether what you're using the correct level of analysis. In terms of aggregation problems, there's obviously a wide variety of different possible area units that you can put together when you're specifying a crime risk model. And OpenSure actually calculated that if you were to attempt to aggregate 1,000 objects into 20 different groups, you'd be faced with, and the exact number is 100,260 different solutions. So there's a lot of different ways in which you can add together your boundaries. And this is just this is some old research that kind of visualises that particular problem. We've got burglaries per 100 households here from an area of Liverpool, and we can see on the left-hand side that we've used beats to illustrate the degree of the problem, and on the right-hand side we've used these automatic non-overlapping boundaries, in this case polygons, because we thought they looked kind of neat. And you can see that what I've done here is that I've actually specified the same scale on the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So those that are reddest areas here have got 6.7 burglaries per 100 households or more, and I've made sure that the next ones down are the same across the two different maps. So what you can see by just looking at this is that they're showing very different areas of hot problems when it comes to the burglary issue. And something that's particularly insightful is, for instance, this area on the right-hand side doesn't appear at all on the left-hand side map. So if you use beats rather than these automatic boundaries, you wouldn't even think that the top right-hand corner had a crime problem at all. And also you can see that sort of even within the areas where they're both saying it's hot, on the left-hand side here we have a sort of area where it doesn't look like so much of a problem if you look at the beat level, but if you look at the alternative type of boundary, you can see that there are problems occurring at a greater level there. So just by doing that simple example, you can see that the boundary that you use is really important with the type of visualisation of the problem that you end up with. Okay, so that was some very early work. I want to move on a little bit to some more recent work that I've been doing with colleagues at the Jill Dendo. We were interested in whether we could find ways of producing maps that were good at predicting where future crime might actually fall. And this is obviously very useful to the police and other agencies. So what I'm going to do over the next three maps is compare the relative accuracy of crime maps for the same period of time. And these are burglary maps in particular. For the map shown, we've used two months' worth of data from the 1st of August to the 30th of September 1997, but the period isn't that important, really. And then to have a look at the accuracy of these maps, we've then used the 1st of October onwards, and we've plotted where the problem happened after this map this map was conducted, was produced, if you like, to see whether or not where the recent data is telling you crime is going to happen is where it actually happens in the future for different types of methods of mapping. So you can see first of all here that I've got hot beats, which is the police administrative boundaries, and you can see where hot beats are specified picks up some of the future problems in these areas over the next 7 days. These dots are where the future residential burglary occurs. There are quite a lot of residential burglaries that happened over the next 7 days that weren't picked up by the hot areas for this particular example. Moving on, here's what we call a traditional hotspot map. For those of you that doesn't converse with crime mapping techniques, this is a kernel density function with a bandwidth of 200 metres for the same area of interest. And what we see here is obviously the hottest areas are in the deepest red. And again, in a very similar way, we've plotted where the future burglaries are over the next 7 days on top of that. And I think you would probably all agree with me in saying that looked like it picks up more of the future crime problem than the previous map did by using that function rather than just using an administrative boundary. Now, this map is what we call a perspective map. And whilst I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail of why a perspective map is any different from a kernel density map, for instance, I just want to say that it's been produced using some theoretical concepts that people such as Mike Towsley and Shane Johnson have been working on as well, and they're going to talk about them in more detail later in the week. But I just want to summarise. Basically, this map assumes that a degree of burglary risk spreads in a similar way to a communicable disease. Okay, so it spreads perhaps in a similar, so those that are in close temporal proximity to a particular target are more likely to be infected. So if you like, you can think about this in some ways in a similar way to the common cold. But we're spreading in a similar way to the common cold, but with a much sort of lower infection rate. So only a certain amount of it propagates like that, but it propagates to a certain extent like that. And so we've built that into this particular type of mapping called perspective mapping. And we wanted to see how that compared with the other techniques. And you can see again that it seems to be picking up, those hot areas seem to be picking up a lot of the future problem within the next 7 days. But I don't want you to take my word for it, because one of the problems with just visualising it like that is you can't really be sure. We need to start getting measures for assessing how good this map is compared to those other two maps that are more statistical or quantitative in their nature. So that's what we set off to do. And so we came up with a couple of concepts here. We've had, first of all, map accuracy, which was the number of hits. How many of those future burglaries are actually within hot areas according to a particular type of hotspotting? But it would be very easy to have 100% hit if you said the whole of the area was a hotspot, okay? So, of course, what you have to do is also take into account the unit area that you call hot, okay? So that's the search efficiency rate, so it's hits per unit area. So we compared the maps on that, and we also thought it would be important to compare on what we've called map practicality in terms of the number of hotspots that have been generated by different techniques and the size of hot areas. And the reason why we call this practicality is to say you've got a very good predictive system, but the map is so fragmented on where's hot that it would take the police all their time to just rush between those different areas. That's not a very practical way of policing. So it might be better if we have a sort of more sort of cohesive areas that we can go between. And there's probably going to be some sort of compromise. There's going to be some sort of midpoint at which the number of hotspots is manageable. Okay, so how do these maps compare on those different measures? Well, in terms of accuracy, first of all, this is the percentage that the different types of techniques picked up over the next week. So we can see that our perspective map picked up 64% of the future burglaries compared to the beat map, which only picked up a quarter of the future burglaries according to its hot areas. And then if you actually take into account the area that we've called hot, we can see the search efficiency rates per kilometre square over 2 days, in this case, of future prediction. And again, we can see that the perspective map seems to be better in terms of search efficiency. It's saying where the hot areas are likely to be in the future. In terms of practicality, and here I, for some reason, left off the beat map, unfortunately. But we can see that one of the compromises that you might have to make is that the traditional hotspot map was actually better at producing sort of cohesive areas. So there was only 19 of those, whereas the perspective one had sort of getting onto 80 hot areas. So there might be some sort of trade-off between accuracy and the number of hotspots that a police officer might manage to get to. So it's just one thing to consider. Okay, so far... I've been talking about accuracy and practicality, and we've just really, in the analysis we've just described, the underlying opportunity structure or spatial field that we've used has been assumed to be uniform, and this is obviously, as we all know, very unlikely to be the case in reality. So there's a lot of things about the underlying opportunity structure or the backcloth that we should take into account. As well, and we might be able to come up with more accurate crime risk models if we do that. And I just brought up a couple of concepts here which are relevant. Firstly, that of the opportunity structure, so things like land use, the distribution of houses, housing type and tenure. We call these flow enablers, because as coming back to this idea of crime being like a disease, some of these things help enable the flow of burglary to other areas. So similar housing types between areas might be something that helps enable the flow, for instance. The distribution of housing is going to assist in some cases, but we have to take into account some of the stuff that Bill Hillier has shown this morning as well, in terms of whether or not, for instance, density is going to help the flow or impede the flow. Coming on to that, that brings me nicely onto friction, which is things like, for instance, topology. So waters or railways, it could be things that deflect the flow from propagating nicely. It's more difficult for somebody to get over a waterway or a railway. Crime prevention activity hopefully deflects the flow or causes friction in these propagation models, as to certain social factors such as perhaps affluence and cohesion. And then we have facilitators, which is a concept that Brantingham's used. And here we've got things like proximities to bus stops or major roads, for instance. So we need to really be factoring these types of things into models as well, if we can. Okay, so we did a very simple model of trying to account for some of these different background or backcloth variables. And what we did was we were able to use GIS to do some vector grid mapping at 50 metre grid squares across our area of interest. And we literally just had two different data sets that we used here to see how bringing in these factors really helps. The first was Ordnance Survey landline information, which was basically showing you the number of houses in each square, but also the physical area of the square that was used that was covered by housing. And I'll show you how that actually looks in a minute or two, so we could see the physical footprint of all the houses as well. And in terms of roads, we used number of sections of roads running through grid squares and length of the road running through the grid square. And we could classify that into major and minor. These are very simple methods of backcloth. And what we then did was we went off and we weighted our squares in terms of housing alone, roads alone, and combinations of houses and roads. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to sort of filter our prospective model through this backcloth to see if you combine these two bits of information, you end up with something more powerful than just doing all the other thing in isolation. Okay. So this is just a sort of illustration of mapping those layers, and we can see our 50 metre grid squares here, and you can see in certain ones that there's this is Liverpool, so you can see that area at the top left hand side is an area of terraced housing, or row housing as you might call it over here in the States. But this actually also highlights a problem with just counting buildings, and you can see this building for instance takes up an entire square, and there might be a residential postal address that's related to that whole building, but that's a very different type of property to these small row houses you can see up here. So there's going to be variation across the different types of building. So that's one thing to consider. But the other thing that you can see from this is how important it is to take into account backcloth, because this is showing our prospective map without accounting for backcloth. And this is basically saying where the prospective algorithm thinks future crime is going to happen. And we can see that there are actually some squares here where there's absolutely no residential property in there. So we know immediately that that's a silly place to say that future crime is going to happen. So we can filter that out of the equation quite easily by just saying if there's nothing in that square, let's just forget about it. Okay. Now, this shows you how we've tried to visualise our accuracy calculations across these different mapping methods. We've done these using concentration curves. And what you see here is a variety of different lines which I'll try and explain to you. The first one, this ProMap line, shows you how accurate the prospective algorithm or the mapping algorithm is on its own at picking up future burglary. So to give you an example, for instance, if you take 15% of the area on the prospective mapping algorithm, we capture 40% of the future burglary. So it shows you the level of concentration there that you pick up. Okay. Now the trouble with that is we say, so what? Is that good? Is that not good? We don't know. So something that we need to do is compare against chance. And we've actually managed to come up with a way of doing this, which is basically by using Monte Carlo simulation to come up with a chance distribution. So what you basically do is you just pick your grid squares out of a hat and you say the first one out is going to be the hottest and you keep going until the last one and you say that's the least hot. And if you do that, how does that compare to what these perspective maps are showing? And you can see that we've done that. But instead of just doing it once, we did it 99 times. So we've got a proper distribution for chance here that we can compare against. And you can see also here the 95th percentile. So really broadly, if you find that your concentration curve is outside that 95th percentile, it looks like it's more effective than chance at picking up where the future burglary is going to be. Did everybody follow that concept? Okay, so we can see that ProMap is pretty good at doing that. And in fact, coming back to that 15% measure, if you compare ProMap, which picks up 40% of future burglary, we find the chance simulation mean picks up 20% within that 15% of areas, and the 95th percentile only gets as far as 30%, so we can really see that ProMap is doing better at that level. At 30% of the area, ProMap picks up 70% of future burglary compared to 50% for the 95th percentile. So again, we can see at these sort of levels, the perspective mapping algorithm seems to be outperforming chance. So how does this compare to some of the other models? Well, this is just the retrospective and the kernel density estimation model on its own. And we can see that it sort of bobs along, being better than chance at some point, but it isn't for a very long duration there. And this one is particularly surprising. The BEAT model, which is the first one that I showed you, actually performs far worse than chance. And this really terrifyingly is what the police often use when they're going off to decide how they're going to do their operational policing. So, you know, this shows how important the boundary issue is in trying to produce reasonable and predictive systems. Okay. Now, I said that I was going to talk a little bit about how bringing in the environmental backcloth assists with things. And here is an example for when you bring in, sort of, you filter through ProMap with both the roads and the houses in the environmental backcloth. And you can see from this picture that, again, it's outperforming chance. And it seems to be outperforming chance even better than just the perspective mapping algorithm on its own. Which shows you that just very simply, if you very simply try and take into account the opportunity surface, you can already come up with some gains from doing that, basically. So if we again have a look at this, we've got 15% of the area, and here we've got 50% of the burglary. And if we use ProMap on its own, the perspective mapping algorithm on its own, that's only 40% the future burglary. And if we get to 30% of the area, we compare 70% for this particular algorithm, which combines things to 70% for ProMap alone. So again, it shows that it's worth putting in stuff about the environmental backcloth, however simple. Okay, now this is a bit complicated, so I'll try and explain what we've done here for at least one case, and then you can think about the rest of the table yourselves. One of the problems that I've just showed you is this. We could have picked a really good day for predictions. So the day that we picked to do this experiment could have been really good for prospective mapping and not so good for some of the other things, and that could be why we're getting the results we're getting. So we thought it is quite important to have a look and see whether or not this is true on other days as well as the day that we particularly chose. And so we did it for 9 different time periods, which doesn't sound like a lot, but believe me, for the amount of calculations that go into these tables, 9 is quite something. So what we've got here is we've got the percentage of burglaries that were identified in a certain percentage of cells. So if we just look at the ProMap one on its own, we've got that we've got searching 1.3% of the cells identifies 10% of the future burglaries. And that is, if you compare that, for instance, with the simulation mean, you have to search 7% of the cells to get those 10% of the burglaries. Okay, what we've done here, the subscript tells you how many of the 9 models that we've done each thing for outperformed the chance level. So you can see, for instance, that for our prospective mapping on its own at 10%, it outperforms the chance level on all 9 of those different calculations we did. And what we've bolded up here is we've bolded up the best performer for each of those different percentages. Okay, so we can see here that the best performer tends to always be ProMap combined with something else. But the interesting thing is, it isn't just ProMap on its own. It seems to be these combination models that are effective, particularly towards this end of the predictive scale. So it's quite good at telling you where things don't happen, including roads and other things. Okay, so that just shows you that you can you can actually have a look at accuracy by doing these types of by using these types of methods. I'm not going to be very long, Henk, you'll be pleased to hear. I'm just going to talk about one extra piece of work and then I'll sort of sum up what we think we can do in the future. And this is a final piece of previous work that highlights issues concerning the unit of analysis and illustrates the importance of individual characteristics in assessing risk and how this interacts with local area characteristics. And this is sort of, it's very important we think about how this work relates to the sort of work that Bill Hillier was talking about this morning. So what we've got here is we've got the number of households that were burgled of different types over a 5-year period for Merseyside. So we can see just looking at the numbers that we've got that semi-detached houses overall had a greater number of offences against them. But when you take into account the denominator, in other words, the number of houses of that type, we can have a look at the prevalence rates across those different types of dwelling. And what we can see is overall here, according to this data, detached houses are a fairly low risk compared to the other types of houses. And this is across the whole area of Merseyside aggregated up. And we can see that perhaps flats and semi-detached houses seem to be at a higher risk in terms of their prevalence rates. But this is too simple a story, as Bill was pointing out this morning, it's about interaction. So what we've done here is we've got the same data, but now we've separated it into 5 different area types. And here, quintile 1 is the most affluent 20% of areas, and quintile 5 is the most deprived 20% of areas. And what you see that's quite interesting here is that there's some sort of interaction effect going on. So if you look at detached houses, you see that they're at the least risk, they're the type of housing at the lowest risk in the most affluent 20% of areas. Okay? But by the time you get down to the most deprived 20% of areas, you see a different pattern altogether. Being a detached house in a very deprived area puts you at a far, far greater risk than any other housing type. So there's a serious interaction between the individual and the local area here, and I think quite often people forget about these interactions when they're specifying crime risk models. So it's about the fact that it's a more complicated picture than it's just the type of housing. What you need to do is you need to think about, and I don't think crime prevention practitioners know this stuff enough, that you ought to be doing different things depending on where you are in terms of trying to make people safer. Okay. So I've sort of tried to highlight some of the problems with specifying crime risk models here and how your definition of boundaries and your definition of land use really affects how good your models are at predicting where crime is going to happen. So what do we think that needs to be done next? Well, it's exactly the type of work that Bill does, basically. We've only just accounted for the extent of erosion in an area. What we need to start doing now is think about connectivity and accessibility, and whether or not that particular square is just 2 extra squares from a big motorway, or how does the road network connect up, and what can we learn in terms of accessibility there. And I think if we start doing some sort of analysis, quickest path analysis or whatever we decide to do, again we should be able to make our algorithms even more predictive if we can take into account how the road networks connects up and the importance of permeability and accessibility. Okay, where next? And the second thing I think needs to be done are more multi-level models, and this sort of comes out of the work I showed you with the interaction between the household type and the area type. I think we can sensibly come up with some better models that work both at the individual level and the small area level and the large area level, and they take account of all those things altogether. So one of the ways that we could do this is look at the victims versus repeat victims. And why it might be sensible to do this is we don't know enough about non-victims really to be able to do this type of work. But what we do know is stuff about victims, because we know all about their MOs and their characteristics. And we know stuff about repeat victims. So we can take those 2 groups and compare them against each other at the individual level. And we can do things like take into account housing type or MO of offence. So we can model those things at the individual level. We can then add in a small area level. And I think this is one that's often forgotten about. This sort of cell neighbourhood area level that's perhaps not as big as anything administrative, but we can start modelling accessibility and housing details at this particular area. Perhaps general crime risk as well can go in at this level. And then at the larger level, you can put in your social and demographic information. So I think models that look across those different levels of aggregation is going to be one sensible way forward. And finally, and this is the best slide in my presentation, and unfortunately it's nothing to do with me, okay? This slide was prepared by Joanne Turner at the University of Liverpool. And you might wonder how I got hold of such a good slide. And the answer to that question is because my dad works in the maths department there and has been working on this type of subject with colleagues for a long time. So thanks, Dad. So this shows you a cellular automata model that they've been developing over there. And I don't really know how these work in great detail, but what I can start telling you is some ways in which this might apply to crime problems. First, we have here a model which shows a pathogen extinction model. And so this would be if you had a very short infectious period of a particular disease. Okay, and what you can see happening here is at this point here, we have an infection starting, and it propagates through the population, through the susceptibles, which the ones you can see in yellow, and those susceptibles then gain immunity, but we've also accounted a little bit for our backcloth because we've got unoccupied cells in there that have got nothing in them that can propagate this problem. The interesting thing here is this is when you've got a short infectious period, and we see that it ends up having what we call pathogen extinction later on. So it goes through this particular area and then it drops out. Okay, but this shows you a different situation where you've got a longer infectious period, and this time they have it for a longer period of time. So what happens is that the spread of it is different, and it gets to this situation where there's host pathogen coexistence. So it keeps bumbling along at this type of level. I think probably crime will be falling into more this type of category than this type of category. I don't know if you agree with me. So I've been thinking and trying to pick my dad's brains on how we can apply some of these models to crime. And I've just got a couple of things to say about how I think that might work in terms of parameters of models. First, I think we need to think about reinfection rates. One of the things with crime that is a problem is once you've got your disease, you can have it again at a future time. Okay, so it's not just simply once you've got it, you're immune for life. We have to think about reinfection rates and different levels and lengths of immunity. You can actually model different lengths and levels of immunity. We might want to build into those models things like target hardening or police patrolling, so people have an immunity for a certain length of time and then it switches itself back off again. You can have greater susceptibility in some areas than others, so we can sort of start thinking about our backcloth and about things like the type of area in which something is located. We might say it's more susceptible because it happens to be in a more deprived area, and so you're more likely to catch it that way. The other thing that we need to take into account is that infection can begin from and reoccur in different areas, because you saw those models that I just showed you. They came from one source, but that's not how crime happens. So apparently you can do something called a random spark model, which sets things going across the area in different places, and you can see how that sort of combines into a infection model of crime risk. The great thing is weak infectious models are possible, and I think this is important because whilst we do think burglary risk is infectious, we think it only is to a certain degree. It's not like having a really easily propagating common cold going through the population. So we want to just say, okay, so your chance is only this percent of actually catching it. And you can also have non-uniformity of contiguous cells, and by that I really mean basically that you can decide whether or not you want to put a house next door to the area of risk, or you can start looking again at introducing sort of variation in backcloths in these types of models. So it's apparently possible to do, but I'm no good at the sums, and we could do with people who are good at the sums, basically. So I think I'll just leave it there.